Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Better All the Time and Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Both Better All the Time and Fast Forward Radio are audio productions of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At Better All the Time and Fast Forward Radio and on The Speculist, we talk about emerging technologies and emerging possibilities. We talk about what's happening in the world today, where we think the world is going, and we talk about the future. And we're not afraid to take an unusual view of the future. We believe that there's a pretty good case to be made that the world is getting better all the time, that if you're not excited about the future, you're just not paying attention. And we believe that something is going to happen, something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and I'm joined in the virtual studio by my co-blogger, co-host, and co-futurist, Stephen Gordon, as we welcome our special guest.
We're very pleased to bring Brian Wong back on Fast Forward Radio once again. This was a little bit of a last minute deal. I was just so impressed by a post that Brian put up on his blog, Next Big Future, that I thought, well, this is a topic that we absolutely have to address on Fast Forward Radio, and in this case on Better All the Time as well. And so I asked him, and he said if we could do it at a different time than our usual time, he'd be amenable. So we've worked that out. And Brian, I believe you're with us now. Is that right?
Yes, I am.
How are you?
I'm doing great.
Well, it's great to have you back on the program. And I should mention that Brian is the director of research for the Lifeboat Foundation, as well as being the, chief blogger, editor-in-chief over at NextBigFuture.com. So, Brian, we were talking a little bit about this idea of collapsitarianism, if that's the correct term. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, there's a bunch of different names for them. You know, I think collapsitarianism is the newest term, I think recently coined in an article a few months back in the New York Times. There's also doomers, dystopians, probably similar to the kind of people who may have held signs saying the end is near at various points throughout civilization, maybe thinking that everything's going to collapse, we're all going to die, except perhaps it's more elaborate, more sometimes more scientific reasons for why something like that may happen. For the environmental collapse, that we're going to ruin our ecology, our agriculture, thus it'll bring about mass starvation, population levels will drop drastically, if not to zero, down to a billion or two from our current 6.7 billion or so. And there could be reasons like people feel retribution because of being immoral for some reason, or because they're anti-global, anti-American, anti-Western, anti-development, anti-technology. So that's the basic core of that kind of thinking.
So there's any number of reasons why people might want to look at the world as being on the verge of collapse. And you list a number of them in this piece, and you've just kind of gone over them now. Do you think it's a fairly new trend that we have so many different people with so many different kinds of emphases on how the world can fall apart?
I think historically it happened in various waves as to why it is, but it's definitely not new. I think around the turn of the millennium, 1000 AD, I think still a record of a lot of people thinking that the end was near. Oftentimes there's been various religion things where people say the end's going to happen soon for whatever reason. I think more recently, because you have real science and technology developing to the level of interest only, say, at most 300 years ago with the real scientific method, that you would have more scientifically based reasons why this would happen. I think even there, there's been various points where people have thought it would happen. Malthus, economists, and various other things have had that kind of have reasons for it. But the more recent one, of course, is Al Gore popularizing the climate change reasons, and but he kind of picked up on stuff that other people were working on. Other scientists, there were some various bets about kind of between what they would call, I think, Malthusians or cornucopians and stuff, the way they're going to run over resources. So even that happened,
right.
some bets around that, 30, 50, the Club of Rome kind of stuff, where they've had that.
Well, what one of the things that is really interesting to me is the different levels of kind of investment that these different groups have in the idea of a total collapse. And you talk about mm-hmm. how some of the Luddites, some of the anarchists, people who are just kind of anti-humanity, anti-civilization, that they want the collapse to come about as quickly as it possibly can. But there are others who would say that they're opposed to it. But, I mean, take Al Gore. Obviously, he doesn't want a terrible a climate disaster to occur. But at the same time, if all of the research that has backed up everything he said were tomorrow completely disproved, you know, he wouldn't look great, right? I mean, people
right.
have a certain level of investment in just the fact that I've been talking this thing up for a long time, and you know, it would be embarrassing, if nothing else, to have to back away from it. And another one that you mentioned were the survivalists, and I think those are people who, you know, they would tell you they don't want civilization to break down, but I think they're just kind of stocking up on the ammo, stocking up on the food, kind of thinking, well, hey, I'm ready. You know, I mean, there's kind of in a sense looking forward to it.
When it hits the fan, I'll be the one guy on the block that can, you know, that'll be surviving. You know, I think there's a little bit of, I don't know, if it's Schadenfreude or what it is, but I think that there are those who. Both on the left and right politically. It's funny, you know, politics doesn't have much to do with the collapsitarians because they come from all spectrums, all across the spectrum, don't they?
Right, right. Even there's kind of like not people who are super, you know, like this shade of negativism that they can have, and sometimes they can even be right. Like you can say a financial guru who, you know, and there have been various ones who would always be saying, you know, I'm forecasting the Dow is going to drop and the various stock markets are going to fall. And, you know, they can even always be, you know, kind of like on a roulette wheel, or not a roulette wheel, but in craps, you know, the dice game, always being against people making it, kind of the opposite end of it. And, you know, they can do fine financially that way. You can have, Kamali's guy. There was two guys that started up the Quantum Fund. There was one of the ones who's a billionaire who's betting against the British pound. I'm trying to remember the guy's name right now.
Is that Soros?
Soros.
Yeah.
So he's basically betting against stuff, and he's saying how these negative things are going to happen, and he can even, you know, make big money doing it. There's other financial gurus who will say, you know, always, you know, buy gold, you know, betting against the markets and stuff like that, and you know,
yeah, I assume I read that Soros is having a very good recession. According to him, he was saying that. I don't know that I would go out and say that. That's, you know, that's a bit like being Leona Helmsley. I mean, that you're in line for being the most hated person in the world if you're out there saying I'm doing great. The rest of y'all can just, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, and then there's also the gurus who are saying we're going to run out of oil and stuff like that, so they can. Make a good living and be, you know, experts in doom. So there's the kind of like amateur people who are just saying things are just really going bad and always whining about it, and there's some who are working towards it and some are just finding a way to profit on the dips.
Right.
Even if it doesn't go all the way down, they could be very intelligent about it and still, you know, do all right. But then there's other times when, like, I think there was a famous financial forecaster who predicted, say, a drop in 87, and then he was, like, the clock was right once or twice, and that, you know, after he kept predicting bad things happening, but then in terms of, like, financial follows, but they didn't happen in a big, long run-up. But then,
right.
You know, you have another collapse, and the clock is right again, and they're saying, hey, look, I'm right again. Ignore the fact that I was wrong for 20 years.
Right. Well, I guess, Brian, let me just ask a follow-up to the, you know, your article on your blog post on this was mm-hmm. very positive and very optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
But we always are going to see ups and downs, though. I mean,
right.
in financially and everything. So, I mean, but you're saying that there's basically a bottom below which we're not likely to go. Is that really your point there?
Right. One of the points I was trying to make is that a lot of these scenarios where they say, okay, and then things spiral down and we lose population down to 0 to 2 billion. You know, let's say it's 600 million or something like that. So basically 90% of the people die. Not only do we stop growing in population, which, you know, normally would project that we'd go up higher, 8, 9 billion, like that, we're going to spiral on down to 600 million. And usually that's going to happen over several decades. It'll start, or has already started, but it'll start by 2025 and then by 2100. That's a typical scenario involving oil runs out, we start fighting for resources, we can't grow enough food, and the oceans go acidic and that kind of thing, and then we collapse down to that level, right, over the course of 70 years. So basically, that's basically saying, roughly, that for 70 years, we're going to average losing about 100 million people per year, and it'll be this long decline.
Right.
We'll be constant depression and stuff like that, and things will be, you know, basically heading toward, you know, the Mad Max movie kind of situation, right? And these people are often saying, and, you know, we're going to ride this out because we're going to be growing our own food, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to have my own garden, and this, I'll be okay, and then you heathens will be in the cities and collapsing.
Yeah.
So I say that kind of scenario is complete BS, because once you get a clear signal, like you lose 100 million people, say, next year, right?
Okay.
Double the normal 50 million people we lose to aging. And we're losing them for clear things like starvation stuff. And if it happens, you can have a million people die from starvation in Africa. It happens fairly regularly. But if it starts happening in the West or in, you know, something relatively, you know, one of our quote-unquote advanced nations, right?
Right.
Then that would be a relatively clear signal for, hey, we got to do something, right? So in spite of whatever you think of the leadership, oh, I don't like Obama, I didn't like Bush, whatever, a clear signal of the scale of World War II. Because basically you lost in World War II about 100 million people over the course of, you know, the 5 main years of the war, and where that's been long. I mean, 5 main years of the war, you lost about 100 million people over the world.
Okay.
If you lost that many people, it's a clear signal. It's like in your face, things must change, we need to do something, right?
Right.
So once you get something as clear as that, and I think even before, something that clear, then World War II, what do? We're losing, you know, so many people per year. We go into rationing of food. The British did it during and after the war. Rationing of food, rationing of oil. And if you go to that, you can basically survive on 10%. And while doing that, you can still mobilize your population to a war-level mobilization. Basically, you're rationing and you're building up and knocking out, you know, a bunch of tanks, a bunch of stuff. In this case, you could rebuild your economy with electric cars, right? I can say, okay, rationing of food, rationing of oil, and we're sending out the National Guard. We're going to scoop up all the SUVs and Hummers and crap like that, and we're going to reissue, fire up idle factories or whatever, and build out vehicles that are 20 times lighter than those other cars. And they're all electric. Because we can make a light electric car that could have decent performance, but the problem is things of safety of in terms of like putting them on the road with one with a bunch of FPVs rolling around out there,
right?
And also the issue of so battery range stuff like that. But all that goes away if you're making 20 times lighter. So if you're making like a 4-wheel bike with an engine in it, like a small pop-out electric engine and with a few batteries, and like currently the China knocks out about 100 million electric bikes. So basically, 2-wheel bicycles or 3-wheel bicycles with an electric lead-acid battery engine, $200-300, right? So you can easily make that many for enough people. So you're not like people aren't gonna be walking around or doing stuff. You could just say, okay, we're going all electric. We're getting serious about it. We're doing it this way, and then you can continue to make them better, tougher, whatever you want. But you could have that thing where you've gone all electric. You can retool your economy. You can say, okay, we're gonna make all nuclear power now, and we're not gonna take 5 years to certify these things, because how much really does paper help me make a safer plant? You know, yes, you want to standardize, you can do some stuff. You're not going to just go willy-nilly make them as shoddy as I can, but you would. We can make them fast. You can just start doing it as opposed to having a bunch of pencil-pushing, meaningless work. You can just start we'll build it. And
right.
China is far more willing to not have that right now, and they – started up and are probably can complete an Westinghouse AP1000, fairly advanced reactor, actually one of the most advanced reactors in the world. They broke ground on it this year, and they should complete by 2013. That's the first one in 5 years. And Westinghouse is saying, hey, you can build these things in 3, right?
Okay.
And China's also working on high-temperature reactor, which they are targeting to build in two years. So people who say, oh, you can't build the reactors fast enough, if you got serious about it, even with current designs that are kind of like being worked on now, you could shrink that down to, 2, 3 to 5 years, and then get faster and faster.
Well, Brian, I was reminded of back in the '60s when we decided we wanted a nuclear navy.
Yeah.
We had a sub of the month club.
Right.
Where we were rolling out nuclear powered submarines we were gearing up for the Cold War, basically, and we were
right.
rolling those things out one a month. So we can do nuclear reactors as quickly as we want to if we're serious about it.
That's right. And the nuclear sub-reactors and stuff and aircraft reactors, they're in the 200 to 300 megawatt range now. And they got some new ones coming out for 600 megawatts. So you can make quite big ones, especially if you're not building the whole sub. You're just building the reactor and
right.
the light. And you can factory mass produce them. You could make, like I said, a sub a month or a nuclear reactor a month if you really wanted to.
Yeah.
So really, the fallacy behind all of these different collapsitarian scenarios, the real problem that we encounter with each of them is that they assume that we will do nothing until the very end, that even as pain gets worse and worse and worse, that we'll do nothing and things will collapse. It takes all of these scenarios don't have our response to a worsening situation. They don't take that into consideration. Is that a fair assessment of how
right? Or they somehow feel that we will be incapable, that the depression that will make us unable to do anything, that because we're running down on oil, that we won't do anything, and that the price will go up, which is driven by demand. So that means that somehow, Joe Sixpack will still be driving his Hummer when oil costs $100 a gallon. Even that basic response of, and then I stop driving my Hummer, is somehow not in their scenario, right? It's only because we run out of the oil that we do that. That the job disappear, all this stuff is going on, and people somehow become immobilized. They can't, I can't move, I can't get off the couch, I have no job, I have to sit here and waste away.
I have a friend who is very closely connected with the financial markets, and probably late last year started warning me that everything was basically game over.
Right.
I mean, the tone of the message that I was getting from him, and he said, it's time to get with friends and loved ones and huddle close I mean, literally, his feeling was that the total collapse, economic and then societal collapse, was absolutely imminent. And I haven't talked to him actually in a while, so I don't know if he's still on that page or not. If he sees hope in the fact that all these months later it hasn't happened yet, or whether he takes any encouragement from the stimulus, or not to get into the specifics of any particular policy, but it seemed to me that the expectation of doom was way out of proportion to any actual damage I was seeing. I mean, it's bad right now. We got 8.1%, I think, last time I heard, unemployment. A lot of people have taken a real hit in their 401ks and stock portfolios, and clearly there's this huge reorganization that's going to have to occur within the banking sector and maybe in the financial sector, generally speaking. But, there's just this real feeling of, yeah, but life seems to go on, and things could get an awful lot worse, and life would probably go on with some other countermeasures in place, right? We'd probably do some other things. There's something about this expectation that we're gonna hit a threshold and then just everything all falls apart at once.
Yeah. Well, also, if you're kind of living in your intelligent person, you're in the area being hit, then you could start getting a more negative view of things. I've lost my job. I can see that other people are gonna lose their job because I'm in New York, I'm in the financial markets and stuff. I can see, what would be, and what is for them a financial, once in 100 years kind of thing, or once in 80 some years since the 1930s kind of thing, something beyond my, say, 20, 30 years of financial experience, and beyond some of the guys who are older than me in experience. This is financially, other than the fact that people who may have been in, say, who work in the Asian markets in 97 or Japan, that kind of stuff, or certain other countries, or Argentina or something like that, they're looking at this thing and saying, oh, it's global, it's worse, it's certainly worse than the U.S. has seen, kind of like that, even though I can say, with 8% unemployment, we had higher unemployment before in the 70s and stuff. But it's still definitely not good. So if you're living through that initially, it's probably like you're sitting in Poland when the Nazis rolled across the border at the beginning of World War II, you're thinking, oh, and this is, doom and gloom, the end. It must be the end for the others because these guys are just so unstoppable, kind of thing, right? So if you're looking at it, then your view could be skewed toward negative. And you can't elevate up to a bigger picture and say, civilization-wise, we're actually stronger and can do more things civilization-wise. If they're just looking at it because they're on the front line of it, that it's kind of like, it definitely doesn't look good from where they're sitting. But if they were to look at, the Main Street view, took a while for it to hit Main Street kind of thing. But they're saying
you go back to that quote that you started out your essay with from President Reagan. If you lose your job, that's a recession. If I lose mine, it's a depression. So I can definitely see where someone who's in that industry, if the industry you're in is the ground is falling out from under you, then I guess the world starts to look a little different. And maybe that's where that's where this kind of syndrome comes from across the board. People who are very close to these issues, they don't focus on one. They don't focus on all the remedies, but they also don't focus on just how generally resilient and strong we are in all other areas.
Can I take the devil's advocate? I want to take the counter argument. I want to just present a counter argument and let you guys chew on it. And I know y'all are going to shoot it down, but let me throw this out. Let's say it's a similar scenario to peak oil, but instead we're talking about peak debt. Okay, at some point, foreign nations stop buying our T-bills because they think that we're unstable. We've spent too much money. Our debt is unmanageable, and so they stop buying our T-bills. And so all of a sudden, our ability to maneuver, at least at the national level, our ability to operate stops at the national level. What then happens? What keeps it from collapsing completely?
Well, there have been nations that have gone bankrupt before. or very close to it, or something like that. I think South American nations, Argentina, other places have had massive financial problems where they were incapable of paying back debt or had to have debt forgiveness and that kind of thing. And or back in World War II or something like that, Germany had hyperinflation. Basically went bankrupt. I'm not sure if they got debt forgiven or not. I think they probably would have had to at some point, maybe after World War II. You know, maybe they racked up some debt there and had to get forgiven it. But if you have hyperinflation, and you see that in African countries now, you know, I think Zimbabwe, where the currency just, you know, you have to roll around wheelbarrows to buy stuff, you can reset from that basically by reissuing script. I think Civil War also, you reissue the money. And basically say, the old money, forget it, it's done. And now we're restarting our
economy. Yeah, because you really can't roll around a wheelbarrow full of cash to buy a sandwich. That's not
right.
That's
right.
Not doable.
Right.
Yeah.
And then if interest rates go through high, then basically you have to put in these controls to keep everyone moving around, doing productive things, still being motivated for it. And the foreign governments would then work with you to do that because they can see, okay, in the old way, we're going to get nothing out of you, or we're going to get it in devalued, in worthless money, right? So that's where you inflate your way out. We're basically, sure, I owe you $10 trillion, $20 trillion, but ha-ha, inflation just went to 200%, and now 5 years later, you know, here's the equivalent of $100 million. Here you go because I've given you with the worth of toilet paper my old money, right?
Yeah.
So they would work with you on it. And also, you know, they would want to see the coming from Vatican. But you can do stuff, and it had happened in other countries before. It's not like people see it as, okay, interest rates go to 100%, and then, you know, yes, it's horrible, and then it stays horrible, and we can't do anything, and I can't get a job, blah, blah, blah. It's like you have to put in a reset of some kind.
Right.
The whole thing. Basically,
well, at some point, you kind of go to a barter system for a time while the economy is being reset, I suppose.
Right.
You know, you're not going to, instead of the wheelbarrow load of cash, you're going to, take something of value out of your house and go trade for what you need for a short time while the currency is being reset.
Right, right. And you do services for the other person. You end up with a black market, basically,
yeah.
Where, okay, I'm trading with you and we're still getting around doing things, but it's under the table because on the table stuff is just all screwed up.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this is Fast Forward Radio and Better All the Time on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Brian Wong about collapsitarianism. And if you're listening to us live, you can join our online chat or leave a comment at blog.speculist.com. Now, I'm going to do something, I think, Stephen, I think unprecedented for either of these two podcasts. You tell me if it's precedented and I've forgotten. Okay.
All right.
I'm going to read a poem.
That is unprecedented.
Okay, this is new. Now, don't worry, it's not one of mine. Okay, just relax. This is a poem by A. E. Hausman, written I'm going to say probably in the early 1920s, probably. The poem is entitled "Terence, This Is Stupid Stuff." And I'm not going to read the entire thing, but I'm going to share a couple of stanzas of this poem. And I'll give the basic laydown is, Hausman starts the poem out from the standpoint of one of his critics, talking about how bleak and depressing his poems are and how unwarranted it is that he writes such bleak and depressing poetry from the standpoint of the life he lives. And then Hausman comes back around, speaker in the end, and he explains why he does what he does. So I'm without further ado, let me read a couple stanzas from Terence, This Is Stupid Stuff by A.E. Hausman. Terence, this is stupid stuff. You eat your victuals fast enough. There can't be much amiss, 'tis clear, to see the rate you drink your beer. But, oh, good Lord, the verse you make. It gives a chap the bellyache. The cow. The old cow. She's dead. It sleeps well, the horned head. We poor lads, 'tis our turn now to hear such tunes as killed the cow. Pretty friendship, 'tis to rhyme your friends to death before their time. Moping, melancholy, mad, come, pipe a tune to dance to, lad. And then he goes on in that vein for a bit, explaining why he should cheer up. And A. E. Housman, the character, is, thinks it over, and he has this response. There was a king reigned in the east. There, when kings will sit to feast, they get their fill before they think with poisoned meat and poisoned drink. He gathered all the springs to birth from the many-venomed earth. First a little, thence to more. He sampled all her killing store, and easy, smiling, seasoned sound sate the king when health went round. They put arsenic in his meat and stared aghast to watch him eat. They poured strychnine in his cup and shook to see him drink it up. They shook, they stared as white their shirt. Them it was their poison hurt. I tell the tale that I heard told. Mithridates, he died old. So, Housman, I believe, is telling us that we have to build up our tolerance to the bleakness of the world, that we have to build up our tolerance to all the terrible things that can happen. And in so doing, like this ancient legendary Greek king, we can build up our resistance and thus survive. So let me throw this back to you, Brian, in question form. Does collapsitarianism help us somehow?
Yes, I think it does. There can be, I guess, positive criticism that they can point out, that the sky would fall if we went straight line down that path. That if we did completely ignore it, then we would end up at, bad spots. So it is worthwhile to say, and we shouldn't really head down too far down that road, that we should, get off our butts to do more before we need to go into mobilization, basically what I would call, the football thing, the two-minute drill, right? Why get so far behind in your scoring that you need to do this, right? You should stay on top of it, and you should also, work to progress and have bigger and better plans so that you don't end up in those things. So, valley point in terms of the environment is, no need to treat it bad. Like why do those things that really screw it up? There generally is not a need for it. Although some of the things that they criticize about may be wrong in terms of how to handle the environment, the organic food movement and certain other things are wrong. But, there's other aspects of it where a more systematic scientific view, larger view, there are better stewardship things we could do. And one of the things, looking at it in terms of the whole, how our economy and how the world is run, often for the last few decades, the U.S. view is the top, number one, most successful and all that kind of stuff, is that, and then you look at the countries that weren't good, many countries in Africa because of corruption. China made a bunch of mistakes until they turned things around in the 70s. And India had far lower growth than they should have because of, I think it was called the Indian Raj system, basically massive amounts of bureaucracy. We can look at those things and say we have a lighter version of those. Even the United States, which is the top number one, clearly there's and it's been relatively apparent, more recently, there's excessive corruption, there's too much waste, there's too many bad plans. Same thing for bureaucracy, the whole 5 years to certify a nuclear plant. The slowdown in general about how fast we can build our infrastructure, like in the San Francisco Bay Area here, it's been, I think, over about 20 years since the Bay Bridge had the earthquake and had the problem. They're still working on it. Back when they made the whole Golden Gate and Bay Bridge over the course of a few years, I think a lot of that has to do with bureaucratic slowdown. It's not all just the fact that we're taking a little more time to make the bridge stronger and better kind of thing. It did hold up, for many decades until you had that problem. So sometimes the excessive bureaucracy and other stuff is not helping. And we need to look more closely at that to see how, you know, the paper that we're putting together, the work for setting up a nuclear plant, is that going to stop the radiation? Are we going to pack these reports all around it and stuff like that? You know, it's like...
Right.
You know, what are we doing?
Block the radiation with all the paperwork required to get the plant open.
I know. So it's... So a lot of these things, in terms of, like, what, you know, we have stalled ourselves out and done a lot of things which I think are stupid, and that we, and also the lack of productive things that come from government, you know, that should be fixed. Like, currently I think the rational thing is to just assume, you know, various agencies will do nothing. We'll assume that NASA will not be able to be the one to lead us into space, because they and the Department of Defense space programs have spent on the order of $40 billion per year. NASA is about $17 billion. The military defense budget, about $23 billion, $40 billion per year for many decades. So basically over $1 trillion of our money now was spent in space. And yes, we have some military satellites, some communication satellites, some nice stuff. But for $1 trillion, we couldn't have gotten full colonies out into space, industrialization, you know, done things to lower the cost of getting to space. You know, instead of building a, in my opinion, relatively useless $100 billion international space station, you know, we should have been building space fuel depots up there. Simpler
right.
things, just holding fuel, just so that we can, the next follow-on thing doesn't cost more than getting to low Earth orbit. Low Earth orbit costs, you know, 5-10 times less than going to other places. If you can get up there, refuel, then it only costs the $2,000, $3,000 per kilogram, per pound, whatever, to get to that point. And then everything else beyond that, you know, doesn't cost more than that. So
sure.
there
we
are
got,
better
you know,
plans.
Robert Zucker on this program, and he's talked to his model is we could have had a working Mars colony, a thriving community of people living on Mars, and it would have cost, his estimate, $10 billion. Even if he was off
right.
by an order of magnitude, that's still only 10% of what NASA has spent over all that time.
Right, right. And we're still patting ourselves in the back, you know, as great as it was for the half dozen trips to the moon, right? You know,
right.
that was in the 60s, early 70s, and then we wound that program down. And even that was, I think, less, you know, it was because we were running up against the Russians, it's kind of like you're talking, and then I had the best Little League team, right? The other team sucked. We had the best Little League team. It's kind of like, you know, the Globetrotters versus the Washington Generals, like, that's not the best competition. You know, they had
right.
the most screwed up economy thing going, and woo, we beat them, right?
And another way of looking at that is like, as you know, here we are, I'm a 40-year-old man bragging on having the best Little League team. Well, maybe I should have done something since then, you know?
Right.
Well, this actually puts me in mind of something. I put a review up. It sort of started out as a movie review of an old movie, a movie from 1936 called Things to Come. And it's interesting, H.G. Wells' book, The Shape of Things to Come, laid the inspiration for this movie, and it covers 100 years of history of Earth. It was interesting to track all the little technological and social predictions that were right and those that were wrong, and one that was way off was the movie ends in 2036, and they're just getting ready to embark on humanity's next big adventure, which is a trip to the moon. So I said, well, you know, they gave us 67 more years lead time than we needed on that. And I was thinking, ha, 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 boy, he got that one really wrong. But the depressing thing is, I wonder if we'll have had another trip to the moon by 2036 at the current rate we're going. You know, is there any good reason to believe that we will?
The question would be, you know, would there be a manned trip by Americans? And that's, very doubtful. It doesn't look like we're heading that way. It looks like the Google X Prize thing where you send up some robots to do some stuff. I think the argument there of robots, there's an argument versus, you know, whether you should do robot exploration, whether you should do human exploration. My thing is you can do some human exploration, but you need to first really hammer on it a lot more with doing robotic things and other plans to lower the cost. While things cost basically the equivalent of a weight in gold, to send stuff up there, then
right.
it's just insane to send a whole person to do something, especially if you can do stuff with the robots. But your robots need to just not just send us pictures. They need to be building the things so that we go there, you know, like putting up the fuel tanks or, you know, turning lunar dust into cement and building out the whole ready-made thing. Like, if you can do it with robots, then do it so that the humans can follow on cheap. And whatever your plan is, it has to be and make it cheap, right? Because leaving
right.
it at the cost that it is now, that's just nuts. You know, how can a plan be good if it's – and then I spend my weight in gold, right? That when you start off with that, it's like bad plan, right? So there needs to be a look at better plans. And also something within the system, like I've heard about, you know, a lot of stories and other things, research, you know, about, say, the nuclear rockets, fine. I've tried to reinvent that so you don't have the radiation and stuff like that. But I can understand the massive psychological, you know, problem people have going that way. I don't agree with it, but I understand it. But there's other plans where you don't, where you can still do better and not have those kind of issues. Like, you know, not spending $30 billion on development of the Ares rocket that they're talking about before you, and spend 10 years to do it before you get anywhere. You can do a lot more with some faster, cheaper approaches to making stuff happen, the Zubrin plans and stuff like that.
Exactly.
So it's not just space, but there's other – one point was about the energy. I've heard that, you know, in over the course of the last few decades, that there are plenty of far better plans for getting nuclear fusion, which would give us cheap, abundant power, than the tokamak plan. But that they would have to run the approval for these plans through the national labs where you have all these guys working on hot fusion, right? The tokamak fusion. It's kind of like, I'm working on this thing, I'm getting paid for it, and then you're sending me this alternative which might be cheaper, might put me out of a job. I'm saying that will never work, right? So it's kind of like,
wow.
You know, that kind of structure where you're putting the first in plan that you've decided, okay, now we're going to pay commitment to it, and we put the guys who are in charge of that in charge of whether we fund any alternatives, it's just nuts. You just
That's
have
craziness
to,
right there.
Yeah. You need to have, you know, like you have to have other DARPA outside the system programs where you say, okay, 80% of the budget is mainstream and 20% is going to alternative breakthrough things, right? And we have to spread our bets around, you know, like a VC, spend a bunch of stuff on small things, prove them out experimentally, and also do more physical experiments of building things for space, for energy, where you can make more test things, build more, prove out the actual hardware as opposed to paper studies. You have to build more, test more, fail more often, and then proceed to what works. I remember that McNamara, who I think was Secretary of State or something like that for Kennedy, he shut down the X programs and stuff for planes because they were advancing and succeeding too fast. That basically
rocket planes, right?
Rocket planes, right? He couldn't do
yeah.
his arms control talks because they were technology was progressing too fast on the planes and various other things. So he shut down. Because that's working too good, I must shut that down so I can talk about this other stuff, right? So
let me just say, this is Fast Forward Radio and Better All the Time on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and we're talking with Brian Wong about collapsitarianism and interesting related problems with bureaucracy and how technology progresses. But it's interesting how these are kind of two sides of the same coin as you look at these bureaucratic difficulties that you run into. It's almost like bureaucracy is this luxury that you can afford when you're successful. If you achieve a certain level of economic success, a certain amount of social success, then you can get very bureaucratic. And yet at the same time, it's like this debilitating disease that keeps you from achieving further success as you go. So because I say it's a luxury because obviously when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, you know, there was no amount of bureaucratic hand-wringing that was going to stop mobilization of U.S. forces at that point, right? When you hit the crisis, or even it doesn't even have to be particularly a crisis, maybe just a perceived crisis, when we decided we had to get to the moon before the Russians did,
Now, again, that's our, okay, granted, our Little League victory, but even so, we were able to marshal those forces, to mobilize the technology industry, to make that happen in a relatively very brief period of time. You consider that we got to the moon in less time than it's going to take for them to get up the replacement building that they're putting at Ground Zero, right? I mean, just by way of, you know, where does bureaucracy really slow you down, right? So if there's a perception of urgency, if there's a perception of serious danger, serious risk, serious pain, then we can mobilize, then we can act. Now, that leads me to ask you, Brian, and I want to phrase this as diplomatically as possible. Are you getting any heat from your friends at Lifeboat Foundation for writing this article about how the world's really not going to end? Is anybody taking that the wrong way, or is that okay with them?
No, I haven't gotten heat over it. I'm not sure how many of them necessarily are that aware or necessarily read it. The Lifeboat Foundation is somewhat more it's not organized. Like they have a lot of people on the board and stuff like that, and they're doing various things, but they're not. It's not of a collective action that is occurring. It's more that people are working on their own issues, perhaps part time, that they think, okay, I'm concerned about this thing, and so I will work on it, write on it, research it, expound upon it, that kind of stuff. And there are some more formal things, but it's not as full-time or as cohesive towards.
Sure, right, because I tell you, when I saw that came from you, I thought, well, it's perfect that it comes from somebody who's affiliated with Lifeboat Foundation, because there's a real distinction between being aware of risks and preparing for actual bad things that can happen and carrying around a vision of how everything's going to hell in a handbasket and is all going to fall apart. Maybe you can help distinguish, since I brought him up, you can explain why Lifeboat is not a collapsitarian organization.
Right. Well, one of the reasons why the Lifeboat is not a collapsitarian organization is that, in general, people aren't as concerned in the Lifeboat about these kinds of decline issues. Although I, you know, caveat that, you know, some, I think, people are concerned about nuclear war, and they're concerned about climate changes as issues. Most of the thinking people are concerned about, you know, large asteroids, certain AI technology development issues, and a few other ones, and worried about the quote-unquote surprise. Well, basically, we don't know all the risks, so we need to basically do the equivalent of backing up our computer hard drive off-site, a plan for civilization. That because we don't know what all the things that could kill us are, because, you know, we haven't done this full analysis, that what can we do in case it does happen? And the usual ones, of the one that we're pretty sure about, or we know for sure about, rather, are the massive asteroid, a gamma ray burst, or some kind of space-based phenomena, which, you know, clearly in our study of astronomy, we know it can happen. It has happened in the past in the large asteroid, and that would basically kill our civilization because it would be this massive hit that would happen so fast. There's no adapting to it. Basically, you know, atmosphere could, you know, turn up to 400 degrees for quite a while, and basically there's no way to survive it. So there's, when you have that kind of situation where basically something so big hits that you can't survive it, then yeah, you can't mitigate it. I can't do a mobilization effort to you know, store up on food or other stuff like that if that's all gone. Although, if you were to plan in advance, you actually had, you know, your civilization prepared to say, okay, let's assume something really bad does hit. You can, you know, try and dig in the ground, do some stuff. There's some ways to mitigate even that if you were to prepare in advance on that. But
it really isn't that kind of the distinction. I mean, with Lifeboat, the emphasis is always on how we're going to mitigate, how we're going to avoid these things, what we can, you know, realistic things we can put in place to to
avoid the end of the world, as opposed to the end of the world is inevitable. It seems to me that's
right. It's always how we get to the spot where, and then even if that does happen, we're still okay. That somehow,
right.
Even if we initially, because the plan is weaker, you can't save as many, but you're always trying to make your civilization more robust so that, the shocks happen and you feel okay. For an individual, I can depend upon civilization and say, okay, I will buy insurance so that when the bad thing happens, the civilization can give me money and then me or my descendants can do something, right? But that's this money depending upon the financial system being there. If the whole system is taking the hit, then you have to say, okay, I have to not a financial thing, but I need to have a backup plan in place. I need to have the plan B, the plan C, plan D stuff there, so that whatever the bad thing was happened, and we can fall back to this position and do something, and then get back up again. So. Whether it's something off the world, in terms of like actually having a space program and building up Mars and doing other things, then if Earth takes a hit and you've already moved over to a lot of things over to Mars, then you have to hit whatever it is, we have to hit both places in order to take it out. And people often talk about, we can't move off Earth, it's impossible, we can't afford it, that kind of thing. It's a matter of having the right plan, the right scale of plan to do something. Currently, we have about 20,000 jet airplanes that move 100 million people around the planet, flying people from, Europe to the United States. If you have 20,000 spaceships of that size able to move a few hundred people, then you can move in less than a year 100 million people off and go over to the moon or Mars, something like that, if you have enough performance in that thing, to have a full interplanetary civilization. And there's ways to build those ships and plans to do that if you're willing to do it. And in terms of the fact that, how much will it cost, there's near-Earth asteroids several kilometers across, 3-5% precious metals in terms of like platinum and other things. It would, of course, change your economy if you're actually to bring that back, but there is plenty of valuable stuff up there. I would argue you don't want to necessarily bring it back. You want to just develop them in place to build out your civilization. And basically do what the Europeans did 700 years ago was to develop all of North America, Canada, United States, Mexico and stuff. Mexico maybe more from some of the other places, but maybe from Spain. Anyway, so it's to develop North America. In order to develop the New World, you had to go over and forth. Like Christopher Columbus, in his first trip was three ships with a few hundred people on it. In his follow-up trip, second voyage, a few years later, he, I think, came with like 12 ships, at least seven ships, with 300 people in each boat, a bunch of supplies and stuff like that, and to come back over. And then there were follow-up trips from other explorers of comparable scale and size in order to develop North America. So in order to develop space, you have to go to that scale. You can't send three guys for 2 weeks and expect them to do squat. If you're going to actually get serious, and we're going to develop this other thing, I'll say Mars, because you can do stuff with the atmosphere or the moon or something like that, you have to develop the resources in place. You can't bring it all with you, and you have to have the ships and the ability to transport a lot of people and stuff. So,
right. Well, it really raises the question of what would motivate what would get people to the level of motivation that they would actually take that step. I remember when PJ Manning was on this program, maybe 6 months ago, we were setting the agenda for the future, and we were talking about all these different developments. And when we talked about beginning the real space age and really moving human civilization out into space, she pointed out that in the past, when these large migrations occurred, when people went to the New World, they went to the New World because there's a few opportunity seekers, but by and large, the people who make up the main "I'm going to go live in this new place" population were so desperate that it was worth the risk, right? The ship might sink, I might get eaten by monsters, or they don't know, barbarians in the New World, but I'll take my chances because it might be better than, you know, what I'm up against here. So do things have to get really bad before we're ready to make that? Actually, the one scenario I told her that I thought would get us into space quickly, you know, if we talk about mobilizing a large number of people out into space, would be if we were in the when worlds collide scenario, right? If if a huge asteroid or like another planet was going to come smash into Earth and it's game over and we've got, say, a 2-year window, that might actually do it. But short of that absolute catastrophe, do you think that people could be motivated to make that, to take that step, or are we, you know, kind of more comfortable and we've got our bureaucracies and we'll just we'll sit back and not do that?
I think the technology and plans have to get good enough so that it can be affordable to smaller individuals and groups here. Basically, the airplane age really got, you know, we had a lot of that being pushed by, you know, a Howard Hughes type, other individuals and companies. Were, you know, Lindbergh flying across the Atlantic, something like that. When an individual can do it, when the technology is there and the cost is sufficient so that an individual or a small group of people or a company can make the go themselves. So you're starting to see some of that now with the what they call the new space industry, with SpaceX, with whatever Bezos is doing with Blue Origin, I forget what it was called, but the Amazon guy, he has also has a secret thing to do some launches and stuff like that.
All right.
Currently, most of them are focused on suborbital, getting a bunch of 10,000 people to pay about $100,000 each or $40,000 each to go 60 miles up and just say, okay, yes, I've gone to the edge, I can see the curve of the Earth and stuff like that, which is somewhat a replacement for some of the expensive trips to Everest for the adventure crowd, the wealthy adventure crowd,
right,
to kind of like build up an industry and then get to the point where you can go that way. So that's one path. Where basically, you go to suborbital, you make a bunch of money there, and then you go to orbital. And actually, SpaceX, Elon Musk, who's running that, is getting almost $2 billion from NASA because NASA's own launch has been so screwed up that he's getting paid to make his launch system, as well as, I think, the guys who run the Pegasus air launch thing. So there are some alternative things coming along. Of course, his costs are still currently higher than a cheap Russian ICBM repurposed launch, but it's at least American now. There's certain political things around that stuff. But there is some headway heading that direction. Still not sufficient for what I would like to see happen, at least not for a few decades. I can see that developing eventually, possibly, to something interesting. Not interesting to my big picture point of view yet, but hopefully with the Google launch system getting better robotics and stuff, to roll out a cheap Mars-like rover on the moon and stuff like that by a relatively private organization. They have cheap lunar landers from Armadillo. So there are some things happening there where smaller individuals and groups are able to do stuff in space. A similar thing I would think would be there's been the big debate about whether to build up, you know, to close the border with Mexico, to have, you know, the big fence or something like that, to build something up there, and they talk about spending billions and billions of dollars to do that and have the government to do it. Recently, the Israelis, I think Tel Aviv University, I wrote about that, have made something called Smart Dew. DEW, where basically it's about the size of a raindrop, costs 25 cents, and it's a sensor which can detect intruders, various other things you can make it detect up to 50 meters away. And so you could basically sprinkle these along the 2,000-mile border with Mexico, base stations and stuff, for I can't see how it costs more than $100 million and maybe for only $20 million, to not just the little sensors, which would be even cheaper, maybe $1 million a year spend. But so then the whole debate around whether we individuals do that, or whether the government does that, becomes different, because individuals, the ranchers along the border, can can allow this electronic security system to be placed along the border, and then the Minutemen become effective, these volunteers who want to police the border become effective, and they also can provide the information to border police and stuff like that. So technology can drastically lower the cost and change the form of the debate. Similarly, I think the thing for space is, again, drive the cost down and then change the form of the debate so that if it's affordable for me to have, you know, with nanotechnology, a space vehicle.
Well, in fact, I wonder if the analogy there isn't really strong just because of the question of the will involved, right?
Yeah.
The issue with a fence versus a security system is that the fence actually stops somebody, whereas the security system just lets you know that you could respond if you wanted to, right?
Right.
So
it
doesn't actually necessarily get you to the solution you're looking for.
One part of the cost got way lower in terms of the detection part of it, but then you have to hook it up to people who will do something. There are people, you know, sheriffs, border police, and our volunteers who are willing to do something. And if you provide the means to that, that could be part of the problem, part of the solution. You could then have other technologies to help, again, make the response easier, do other stuff. It depends how easy you have to make it for the small enough group of people who have the will to do it to make it happen. For space, I believe that there are tens of thousands, perhaps 100,000 people who would have more will to do it if it got cheap enough to make it go. That you have, you know, the wealthy people spending $20-30 million to make their one trip themselves up there. I think that they would, that there is a sufficient group that would be willing to spend money to make it happen. If technology got cheap enough, they'd be part of the vanguard to make it happen. I think there are 10,000, 100,000 people definitely who are willing to do it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the will is a big part of what keeps a full-on collapse from happening. To get back to the original point, I think, you know, just because maybe certain people are maybe apathetic about the future, that doesn't mean that once faced with a real crisis, the society as a whole remains apathetic. You know. And you do what you need to do, and people would tend to cut through red tape when presented with the right amount of pressure, I suppose.
Yeah, I think technology is the key that good plans. I think the good plans involve technology. That, you know, you talk about the will. If the asteroid came along, I believe that things can happen sooner and should happen sooner with better plans. That if you can make a better plan, cheaper plan, things with fewer downsides, whatever people perceive the downside to be, then the choice becomes easier. And I think that's a lot of the problem with some of the authoritarian type plans, getting back to that, is that their plan is unplug from the system, grow your own food, you know, get away from the collapse and that kind of stuff. That's a bad plan. If you're only just saving yourself at some subsistence level, that's a bad plan. You need to have a plan to save all civilization. Like, if you saw that it was going to, if you were for sure, okay, 20 years it's going to happen and civilization is wrecked, why are you giving up on civilization and all these other people? You know, what's your moral justification for saying, and then we'll cut loose from the rest of civilization, and so that 90% have to go so that us 10% good people can live? You know, how can you be a good person if you let 90% go when you had 20 years to respond, right? That to me is, I don't understand the morality of that.
Yeah, that's bad moral math, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really doesn't add up. Well, Brian, it's always great having you on the program, and it's just been fascinating, as always, talking about this evening, but I see we've actually pushed past our time just a bit, so I'm going to ask you if you have one parting shot, one final comment you'd like to make on the subject of collapsitarianism, and then we're going to have to wrap it up.
I would say that that there are, you know, one thing that as a futurist, as part of the Lifeline Foundation, is that I am trying to work on better plans, and also to, you know, probably I'll follow up this writing about the either problem with bureaucracy and corruption, and also the whole vision thing, that too many people have this restricted view of how high civilization can go, you know, too focused on this on the what they feel this downside aspect of things. They're not thinking about how can we bring ourselves up to another level or two. This vision of being able to expand out, really use great technology, really make things better. They think it's utopianism or whatever like that, where we solve things. Technology can solve certain problems. If you have a good plan, you can solve plenty of problems. There's many problems that we had with starvation or the thing like that, which developed nations do not have anymore. But you can get even better. You shouldn't be satisfied with just that. That there are certain problems in terms of social ills which may be more lasting, but that if you really work at the technology and those other kind of plans, there are certain things that those technologies can fix. And so if you can fix them, why don't you? Why don't we just fix those things? Yes, there's still other problems, but where we can use technology to make the fix, why not? And also in terms of the vision of expanding out and I think making more space, I go back to, you know, 400 years ago when the Chinese had a international fleet of boats that they sent around the ocean around Asia and stuff like that, collecting tribute and doing things. And then the emperor burned the boats for political reasons and also for turning inward. People should not burn the boats in their mind. That they shouldn't say, okay, we can't go out, we can't do things. That's for whatever reason, you're burning the boats in your head. You're saying, okay, and we can't do it. I don't know why you would want to do that. But you have to be able to say, hey, we can fix our problems, we can expand, we can do stuff. We don't want to get to the point where we have to throw in these two-minute drills. We should just work better, have better plans now, and make the world a lot better.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's not burn the boats. Or, you know, it's interesting. It's like you told the same story twice. Let's not cancel the rocket plane program, right? It's the same basic problem. Well, Brian, once again, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure talking with you, and we look forward to having you on the program again very soon.
Thank you. Great talking to you guys, too.
All right, Stephen, tell us about the music that we're going to listen to on the way out.
The band is Woodfish, and the song is Melody. So I hope you like it.
All right, a little Melody from Woodfish. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for the program. For everyone listening, sorry for a little technical difficulties here and there, but we appreciate you being with us. And for everyone listening via recording, thank you for being part of the program as well. We look forward to being with you all again on the next edition of Better All the Time and Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.
Cry at night.